with it, I make sure I don't.
Anything else I can bring for you ladies?
No, that's it.
Enjoy.
Thank you.
Well, it is
4:35.
And I'm with Chanel. We're eating at Applebee's, and then me and Chanel are probably going to go to Mayfield. It's a park where we watch really hot guys play basketball, and Cam Newman, he's a babe.
Oh, yeah.
And he's really tan, and I really hope he doesn't hear this or his girlfriend. Okay, anyways.
Okay.
I started staying away from home around 5 or 6. I'd stay outside or go to friends' houses as long as I could till my mom called me home. I can sit down and talk with my parents, but a lot of times it's like Andrew's always trying to explain something about a cheetah or a jaguar, something in the jungle that has no importance to anybody's life, but he just loves to share that information, yakety-yak, and if I interrupt him, he gets mad, and it turns into a tantrum, and my mom tells me to wait, and then it's just like, I don't even want to talk to you guys anymore. I think they understand that I don't have them enough, but there's nothing they can do, and they know that I know there's nothing they can do. If I stay away from it for a long time, like going out with friends and avoiding to be home till curfew, then I'll have more of a tolerance for it for the rest of the night.
Marissa, she has the guts, and I don't. It's like all of a sudden we just had this transfer, all of my guts went into her.
When you're at the age of 11, you're going to have kids, and they're going to tease you and say mean things. It's just a stage you go through in school.
I do not stand up for myself. She stands up for me.
Socially, he needs help, so I have to protect him and be there for him more than a normal big sister would. The neighborhood we lived in,
like back at our old house,
this kid kept picking on him every day and beat him up.
A kid was throwing rocks at me, and I picked a piece of cardboard up to shield myself, and one went over and hit me in the head. I ran to the house crying, and my sister had her PJs on.
And I just said, who? And he said his name, and then I went and found him. I came outside, and I saw him running up the street, so I chased him, and then I cornered him into a fence, and I slapped him. He was scared. He was like in tears. My face, I'm sure, was beet red, and I was like gritting my teeth. I'm like, just touch him again and I'll punch you right in your mouth.
Well, I'm just glad to have somebody like that, even though she can't clobber me if she wants to.
Yeah, I was really mad because nobody can beat on my brother except me.
When we got back from Applebee's, we came upstairs and Chanel and I walked down to the trampoline.
Want to get on, Andrew?
Sometimes if I get really frustrated, I just wish I could change everything, sell him to the zoo, and buy new parents. But then the times where I'm actually appreciating things and I'm not in the moment where I'm steaming mad, I really do appreciate what I have.
He's laughing and he's trying to hold it in.
I don't think I'd change anything because this is what I'm used to and this is my life, and Andrew wouldn't be like the Andrew I know and love if he was different because autism is his whole personality.
I like Marissa. She's awesome and she's best sister ever. The best sister ever. I love you. And I hope nothing happens to you. And I'll give my life for you. I won. Now don't kill me.
Except Me was produced by Erin Davis while she was at the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies in Portland, Maine. Erin won the 2008 Third Coast Festival Best New Artist Award. Her story was first posted on PRX.org. To hear it again or to listen to any of our award winners from this year or years past, come spend some time at thirdcoastfestival.org. This year, the judges selected three entries to receive honorable mention awards, and these three couldn't be more different. Taken together, they show the flexibility of the radio medium, its ability to tell stories of all sizes and shapes, from a dissection of the worldwide financial crisis to a thoughtful meditation on how we digest tragedy and fear. We start with Dreaming of Osama. There's no question that the ever-shifting boundary of the war on terror has affected us all, and not just economically and militarily. It's also seeped into our collective unconscious in unexpected ways.
Like, it turns out, Osama bin Laden has been appearing in bedrooms all over the world, in people's dreams. Here's part of Dreaming of Osama by Pike Malinowski.
I had a dream that I owned a sandwich shop, and one of the workers who worked for me there in the sandwich shop was Osama bin Laden. And he was a very bad worker. I mean, he would show up late for work or not show up at all and not call in. And, you know, people warned me not to fire him because he was a dangerous person, but I couldn't afford to have this kind of worker in my sandwich shop. And so I fired him. People started whispering to me, you know, the word around town was that he was pretty mad and he was bent on revenge. He was going to get me back. So one day I was riding down the street on my bicycle, and it's very quiet and deserted, and coming from the other direction, I see Osama bin Laden. He's riding the rustiest, creakiest, squeakiest piece of junk bicycle that you've ever seen. And he stops about 20 paces from me, and I stop, and it's quiet, and we're staring at each other. Shopkeepers shuttering their shops, and mothers bringing their children indoors. And he says to me, "Your days remaining on this earth are strictly numbered." And then he just rides off, creaking and squeaking the whole way.
I don't know where he is, nor do I, you know, I just don't spend that much time on him, really, to be honest with you. I'm more worried about making sure that our soldiers are well supplied, that the strategy is clear, that the coalition is strong.
The traditional Freudian view of what dreams and nightmares were about, there was something very, very dark and frightening that lay in our unconscious. But it was important that our brains and minds didn't reveal what that was to us. So if we look at the dreams of Osama bin Laden, the argument would be that the dream is an attempt to transform something very dark and dangerous into something mundane and everyday, in an attempt to try and live with this terrible fear.
So at one point during my time with bin Laden in this dream, he takes me into a screening room. It's got red carpeting and the curtains on the wall, red velvet, very comfortable seats. And actually, one of his people even offers me some popcorn. And bin Laden says, "I'm going to put on a film. It's a whole movie from my childhood, my teenage years, actually." He sits down next to me, smiles at me as the film's starting. And it mostly is in his kind of teenage years, like, you know, formulative years. And he's wearing kind of Western-style clothes, you know, like nice white cotton pants, penny loafers. He doesn't have a turban on. He doesn't look like a religious man. He kind of looks like a hippie you'd see out in California on, like, the Venice boardwalk. And he's got a nice red sports car. He's got women in the car. He's listening to rock and roll. Leaves are falling all around. So it's just kind of a montage of all these things, you know? He's cutting glasses. He's sleeping late. He doesn't care. He's got his own ideas and his own ideals, and he's got his money. And, yeah, he's just looking for a different way. Sometimes I grow so tired.
That was from Dreaming of Osama by Pike Malinowski with executive producer Alan Hall for Falling Tree Productions. It first aired on BBC Radio 3.
My name is Pike Malinowski, and I produced Dreaming of Osama. I thought it was interesting that, you know, that the dreams seem to be the complete opposite of this picture that the government and the media has painted of Osama bin Laden as this pure, evil, devil figure, you know. And I'm not saying that he is not pure evil. I'm saying that I don't think our minds are really capable of understanding that or relating to that. I think what the dream showed is that our subconscious doesn't accept these good and evil, black and white stereotypes, that we try to humanize him somehow. You know, we need to humanize him. We need to make him human to cope with him, the idea of him, or to understand him, or try to understand him.
Pike Malinowski, producer of Dreaming of Osama. You can hear more from Pike, including his own dream of Osama bin Laden, at thirdcoastfestival.org. I'm Gwen Maxey. You're listening to the 2008 Third Coast Festival broadcast. The festival is made possible with lead funding from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation. Coming up after the break, making cheese when you know nothing about making cheese, and making sense, believe it or not, of the credit crisis. This broadcast comes to you from Chicago Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to the 2008 Third Coast Festival broadcast. I'm Gwen Maxey.
All I can say is that I'd never heard anything so wonderful as the voices that came out of the little box.
The magic of radio.
Dedicated to man's imagination, the theater of the mind.
Listening to radio can attune your ear to the subtle shades of the human voice, which conveys so much expressive information. But in our next story, a farmer possesses the same ability to understand the subtleties expressed by his cows. When you can listen to a moo and differentiate between the bovine bray that means I'm hungry and the one that means I'm lonely, you know that you have really, really gotten to know your cattle. But does that intimacy lead to better-tasting cheese? Farmer Jonathan White thinks it does. Here's our second Third Coast Festival honorable mention, Searching for Farming's Future in Its Past, by Rachel Leventhal.
We have a couple kind of stinky cheeses today. Let me give you the Jean-Louis.
Could I have the other side that looks gooier? Yeah.
I'm Jonathan White. I'm at Union Square Green Market in the Bobolink Dairy booth. Bobolink Dairy is a 100% grass-fed, raw cow's milk dairy farm. The cows are outside, they're eating grass, they're having their calves by themselves, and oh my God, the calves are suckling their mothers.
Jonathan is kind of a celebrity in the world of sustainable agriculture. 10 years ago, he left his engineering job to make cheese. He wanted to learn how to make cheese the way people did it before the industrial age, before fossil fuels. No refrigerating the milk, no freeze-dried cultures, but no one remembered how. So, like an archaeologist, he learned to make cheese from the stories in the Bible and books written for children centuries ago. 5 years later, Jonathan and his wife Nina bought cows, joining a growing community of people called grazers. Farmers whose animals live entirely outside and eat only grass. The idea is to move from the industrial feedlot to small farms and sell products locally. Besides being healthier and more humane, it eliminates the massive amounts of petroleum needed to grow feed, fertilize land, and then transport food thousands of miles to supermarkets. It's not meant to be quaint. They're trying to figure out a sustainable way for us to feed ourselves. People can take cheesemaking classes at Bobolink on Sundays.
We want them to come away with some enlightenment about how food is produced at our farm and to raise their expectations of how all their food should be produced.
So I decided to spend a couple days at Bobolink and see for myself this new, old way of farming.
The government wants me to warn you that raw milk is dangerous.
A group of visitors to the farm's cheesemaking class hover around a stainless steel vat that's filling up with a few hundred gallons of milk that's being pumped directly from the cow's udders.
There's a few little chunks of butter in here.
A few sniff their warm cups suspiciously. The milk is 100 degrees.
Which is going to be a little bit warmer.
Body temperature.
Brunhilde, the red one over there with the big horns, she's my favorite.
After the cheese making, we head out to the pasture to meet the cows.
She's a really good mother.
Jonathan said industrial farmers laugh when he tells them that cows are social animals.
A good mother for her own calf, and she fosters other calves.
Their cows don't interact.
There's different mooings. There's the Jonathan just opened the gate to the new pasture moo. Woo! It's close to the calling a lost calf moo, but there's a little more urgency. There's more moo.
Next day, 6 a.m.
She's calling Mallory, her daughter.
Rainbow, a first-time mother, is blocking the door to the milking barn.
She wants to know where Mallory is.
So we go find Mallory, and then the rest of the cows file in.
In you go. Now, this is a problem. These are our two Dexters, Daisy and Petunia. They're sisters, and they like standing next to each other, and unfortunately, there's no two stalls next to each other.
If I had any doubt about whether there was a difference between these cows and the cows that live in feedlots, they were obliterated by what happens next. Daisy climbed into the next stall, almost laying on top of Rainbow, the nervous mom. So they have to start rearranging all the cows in the barn. Picture a game of Twister, but with cows.
Like I said, it's nursery school in here.
Well, if this were a factory farm and they were doing a lot
more
cows...
They would have been culled long ago.
Jonathan hooks Daisy up to the milking machine. She's an ancient breed of cow. Unlike typical dairy cows who've been bred for productivity and have lost their intelligence and instincts, the cows that Jonathan is breeding are resilient, social, good mothers, and smart.
Drinks over, back to work. Yep.
The cows run to their favorite pasture, which has taken 5 years of grazing to be at its peak nutritionally, exactly the amount of time that the whites have been leasing this farmland, which is about to be converted into houses.
There's already one house under construction.
And that soil that took 5 years to perfect, Jonathan says will probably just run off into the river. He seems to shrug it off. Time to buy his own farm anyway.
But you know what? I'm leaving the topsoil behind, but I'm taking the knowledge of how to make it with me. We know how to make soil. It's called grazing. We got the recipe.
And there were a lot of other grazers around to teach it to him. But for his cheese making, there was no recipe at all.
I had been making cheese for 5 years before I ever met another cheesemaker. Isn't that sad? I think my mentors in cheesemaking died hundreds of years before I was born.
Except for one. Jonathan takes me to meet his first mentor. He lives underground.
This is Jean-Louis.
A cheese.
Which is named in memory of Chef Jean-Louis Paladin, who was my friend and mentor. He passed away 2 years before we moved to the farm.
That's a Mongo cheese.
Yeah.
A humongous, misshapen mold experiment. The spirit of Jean-Louis watches over all the other cheeses aging in this stinky cement underground cave. And today we're going to make another Jean-Louis.
He's the guy that convinced me that I need to go get my own cows. He said, these cows, they need to eat more grass. All the milk tastes the same. You know, he just kept saying, you can do better. You can do better. And then unfortunately, he died of lung cancer. You know, the thing is now, every time I'm making the cheese, every time I'm sampling the cheese to people, whenever I'm selling the cheese, whenever I'm eating the cheese, it keeps the spirit alive.
That was from Searching for Farming's Future in Its Past, produced by Rachel Leventhal with executive producer Daniel Heinerfeld for the Natural Resource Defense Council's On Earth Magazine podcast. Now, this story is something of a landmark in that it's the very first podcast to win a Third Coast Festival Award. This is not your grandpa's wireless anymore.
To see pictures of Dairy Farm protagonists, Daisy and Petunia, and hear the entire documentary, check out thirdcoastfestival.org.
Radio occurs, to my way of thinking, in air. It connects places, invisible places,
and just puts the hairs on the back of your neck up, or makes you lean in to the radio.
It connects places, invisible places.
Now we move from a dairy farm to Wall Street. See how far a radio can take you in a single hour? It turns out that you actually don't need a doctorate in economics to understand the basics of the mortgage crisis that's rocked the global economy. Even if you still think Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae are the corn king and queen at the Iowa State Fair, we can help you. Our third and final Third Coast Festival honorable mention was a joint effort between NPR News and the public radio show This American Life. Together, they set out to explain the credit crisis through the stories of real people, from borrowers to lenders to investors. It's funny, it's frightening, you'll laugh, you'll cry, all the way to the bank. The full story, in all its complexity and detail, takes a whole hour to tell. But here's a taste of The Giant Pool of Money by Adam Davidson and Alex Bloomberg.
The thing that got me interested in all this was something called a NINA loan. Back when the housing crisis was still a housing bubble, a guy on the phone told me that a NINA loan stands for no income, no asset. As in, someone will lend you a bunch of money without first checking to see if you have any income or any assets. And it was an official loan product. Like, you could walk into a mortgage broker's office and they would say, well, we can give you a 30-year fixed rate, or we could put you in a NINA. He said there were lots of loans like this, where the bank didn't actually check your income, which I found confusing. And it turns out even the people who got them found them confusing. For example, a guy I met named Clarence Nathan. He worked 3 part-time, not very steady jobs, and made a total of $45,000 a year, roughly. He got himself into trouble and needed money, so he took out a loan against his house. A big one.
Call it 540 for round figures.
You basically borrowed $540,000 from the bank, and they didn't check your income.
Right. It's a no-income verification loan. They don't call me up and say, you know, how much money? They don't do that. I mean, it's almost like you pass a guy in the street and you say, you lend me $540,000? He said, well, what do you do? I got a job. Okay. I mean, it seems as if it's that casual, even though there are a lot of papers that get filled out and stuff flies all over with the faxes and the emails and all like that. Essentially, that's the process.
Would you have loaned you the money?
I wouldn't have loaned me the money, and nobody that I know would have loaned me the money. I mean, I know guys who are criminals that wouldn't lend me that money, and they break your kneecap. So, you know, yeah, I mean, I don't know why the bank did it. I'm serious. I mean, $540,000, a person with bad credit.
As it turns out, Clarence's friends, acquaintances, and shadowy criminal contacts would have been right not to lend him the money. The time I talked to him, Clarence hadn't made a payment in almost a year, and his house was in the process of foreclosure. And stories like this have been in the news for months, and they often feature an innocent homeowner who is duped by a lying, greedy mortgage banker. Or, if you're more of a Wall Street Journal editorial page type, an innocent mortgage banker who is duped by a lying, greedy homeowner. And no doubt, both categories exist. But Clarence's case is more nuanced and much more common.
Nobody came and told me a lie and told me a story and said, oh, you know, just close your eyes and all your problems will go away. That wasn't the situation. The situation was that I needed the money, and I'm not trying to absolve myself of any. I had a situation, and I thought that I could do this and then get out of it within 6 to 9 months. The 6 to 9 month plan didn't work, so I'm stuck. But if somebody had told me you couldn't borrow the money, I probably would have had to do something else more drastic and dramatic and not be in this situation now. The bank made an imprudent loan. I made an imprudent loan. So the bank and I are partners in this deal.
This imprudent partnership is new, and it's at the heart of the current housing crisis. For most of the history of banking, bankers wouldn't have loaned Clarence their money either. They didn't let people like Clarence near their money, in fact. People with part-time employment and unpaid debts in their past. And then suddenly, in the early 2000s, everything changed. Banking turned on its head, and went out looking for partnerships with people like Clarence, loaning him $500,000 without even checking to see if he had a job. What happened? Well, to help explain what happened, here's my partner for the hour, Adam Davidson, the international business reporter for NPR. Hey, Adam.
Hey, Alex.
How's it going?
Good.
You? Good. I got your title right?
Yes. Okay. Well, not exactly.
Oh, what is it?
It's International Business and Economics Correspondent, actually.
Oh, sorry. It's actually, it sounds more impressive. Okay. So I guess the first thing we have to do is talk about the global pool of money, right?
Right. The global pool of money. That's where our story begins. Most people don't think about it, but there's this huge pool of money out there, which is basically all the money the world is saving now. Insurance companies saving for a catastrophe, pension funds saving money for retirement, the Central Bank of England saving for whatever central banks save for, all the world's savings.
A lot of money. It's about $70 trillion.
That's the head of capital market research at the International Monetary Fund, the place to go if you want to figure out how much money is in the world. All right. So first off, how do we pronounce your name?
That'll probably take, if this goes on air, probably that will take two minutes at least. It's Pazarbashoğlu, Ceyla Pazarbashoğlu.
Ceyla Pazarbashoğlu.
I'm very impressed.
And by the way, before you finance enthusiasts start writing any letters, we do know that that $70 trillion technically refers to that subset of global savings called fixed income securities. Everyone else can just ignore what I just said. Let's put $70 trillion in perspective. Do this. Think about all the money that people spend everywhere in the world. Everything you bought in the last year, all of it, then add everything Bill Gates bought and all the rice sold in China and that fleet of planes Boeing just sold to South Korea. All the money spent in every country on Earth in a year, that is less than $70 trillion, less than the global pool of money.
Wow.
We're talking about a lot of money.
That is a lot of money.
And that money comes along with armies of very nervous men and women watching over the pool of money. Investment managers. They don't want to lose a penny of that. They don't want to lose any of that money. And even more so, they want to make it grow bigger. But to make it grow, they have to find something to invest in. So most of modern history, what they did was they bought really safe and, frankly, really boring investments like treasuries and municipal bonds, boring things. But then right before our story starts, something changed. Something happened to that global pool of money.
This number doubled since 2000. In 2000, this was about $36 trillion.
So it took several hundred years for the world to get to $36 trillion, and then it took 6 years to get another $36
trillion. Yeah, there has been a very sharp increase.
How does the world get twice as much money to invest? There are lots of things that happen, but the main headline is that all sorts of poor countries became kind of rich, making things like TVs and selling us oil. China, India, Abu Dhabi, Saudi Arabia – made a lot of money and banked it. China, for example, has over $1 trillion in its central bank, and there are office buildings in Beijing filled with math geniuses, real math geniuses, looking for a place to invest it. And the world was not ready for all this new money. There's twice as much money looking for investments, but there are not twice as many good investments. So that global army of investment managers was hungrier and twitchier than ever before. They all wanted the same thing, a nice, low-risk investment that paid some return. But then something happened that makes matters worse. At this precise moment, one guy took one of that army's favorite investments and made it a lot less attractive.
This is where we have to talk about Alan Greenspan, right?
Yeah, we have to.
All right, but I'm just going to promise people that this is the only time you're going to hear Alan Greenspan in this story, so bear with us.
All right, here's one of his speeches that really drove that army of investment managers crazy.
The FOMC stands prepared to maintain a highly accommodative stance of policy for as long as needed to promote satisfactory economic performance.
All right, you might not believe me, but that little statement, that is central banker speak for, hey, global pool of money, screw you.
Come on. That's not what he said.
It is. I speak central banker. Believe me, that's what he said.
Okay.
What he's technically saying is he's going to keep the Fed funds rate, that's when you hear the Fed interest rate, at the absurdly low level of 1%. And that sends a message to every investor in the world. You are not going to make any money at all on U.S. Treasury bonds for a very long time. Go somewhere else. We can't help you. And so the global pool of money, which does speak central banker, they understood what he was saying. They looked around for some low-risk, high-return investment. And among the many things they put their money into, there's this one thing that they fell in love with. To get it, they called Wall Street, a guy like this.
My name is Mike Francis. During the beginning of the mortgage implosion, I was an employee, an executive director at Morgan Stanley on the residential mortgage trading desk.
Mike was one link in a chain that connected the global pool of money to its new favorite investment, residential mortgages, the U.S. housing market, and guys like Clarence Nathan. Think how attractive a mortgage loan is to that $70 trillion pool of money. Remember, they're desperate to get any kind of interest return. They want to beat that miserable 1% interest Greenspan is offering them. And here are these homeowners paying 5%, 9% to borrow money from some bank. So what if the global pool could get in on that action? There are problems. Individual mortgages are too big a hassle for the global pool of money. They don't want to get mixed up with actual people and their catastrophic health problems and their divorces and all the reasons that might stop them from paying their mortgages. So what Mike and his peers on Wall Street did was to figure out a way to give the global pool of money all the benefits of a mortgage, basically higher yield, without all the hassle and risk. So picture the whole chain. You have Clarence. He gets a mortgage from a broker. The broker sells the mortgage to a small bank. The small bank sells the mortgage to a guy like Mike at a big investment firm on Wall Street. Then Mike takes a few thousand mortgages he's bought this way. He puts them in one big pile. Now he's got thousands of mortgage checks coming to him every month. It's a huge monthly stream of money, which is expected to come in for the next 30 years, the life of a mortgage. And he then sells shares of that monthly income to investors. Those shares are called mortgage-backed securities. And the $70 trillion global pool of money loved them.
It was unbelievable. I mean, we almost couldn't produce enough to keep the appetite of our investors happy. From our standpoint, it's like, there's a guy out there with a lot of money. We got to find a way to become his sole provider of bonds, of mortgage bonds, to fill his appetite. And his appetite's massive.
The Giant Pool of Money was produced by Alex Blumberg of This American Life and Adam Davidson of NPR News. For the first time in Third Coast Festival history, the story actually won two awards in this year's competition. Because of its insight and relevance, and because it explains so clearly and thoroughly what got us into this massive financial quagmire in the first place, the story won both an honorable mention and a Third Coast Festival Director's Choice Award. We caught up with Alex Blumberg to talk about what it's like to report from the middle of an unraveling mess.
Because these changes happened incrementally over time, the lessening of the standards and easier qualifications to get home loans and stuff like that, because that all happened sort of over time. If you were inside, it was harder to see it. You didn't see it as starkly. But me, I was sort of the perfect idiot to report this story because I knew just enough to know that things had changed dramatically.
Hmm. So what are you working on now and how far do you think it's going to branch out?
Adam and I are now working on a thing for NPR called Planet Money, which has really taken off. It's a daily podcast and blog. I think there is a huge market for business news that isn't written for business people. Reading the business pages is like reading the sports pages if you have no idea how baseball is played.
Right. It's
no
got
idea.
Its own lingo.
You know,
and so,
right, exactly. You don't know what an inning is. You don't know what a bat is. You don't know what an outfielder is, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people don't really know, like, what a bond is. We've been, like, covering really, really complicated stuff on the podcast, like credit default swaps and all these, like, collateralized debt obligations and things that just sort of make your head swim. So I think there is a niche for explanatory financial journalism that isn't hopefully too boring. I mean, just saying that, explanatory financial journalism, makes it sound like the worst possible thing imaginable. But I think there's a niche for stories about the way the world works that are told from a business point of view that you don't need to be a business person to understand.
That was Alex Blumberg, co-producer of The Giant Pool of Money. I'm Gwen Macsai, and you're listening to the 2008 Third Coast Festival broadcast. The festival is made possible with lead funding from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation. Coming up after the break, another story of great impact. A tragedy in Ireland brings a serious social problem to light. This broadcast comes to you from Chicago Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
This is Focus 580 host David Inge reminding you all the programs you hear on AM 580 are made possible by the financial contributions of our listeners.
Welcome back to the 2008 Third Coast Festival broadcast. I'm Gwen Macsai. We're listening to the winners of the 2008 Third Coast Festival Richard H. Driehaus Foundation competition.
Sound is light. We all know that who work in it. Sound reveals. Sound touches. Sound illuminates.
Radio stories can amuse, transport, and engage. And occasionally, they can change lives by shedding light on a particularly important issue or revealing a hidden corner of the human experience. To recognize these stories, the Third Coast Festival bestows an annual Radio Impact Award. This year's winner tells the story of Leanne Wolfe, a young Irish girl who committed suicide. On the day of her funeral, her older sister found her diary, which revealed that she'd been relentlessly bullied for many years by her classmates. Despite their own grief, her parents decided to share her story publicly in an effort to help others. They told the story first to Kieran Cassidy, a producer at RTE Radio in Ireland, who sat down with the family as they read through Leanne's diaries. The diaries charted her transformation from a naive and sensitive young girl to a sad and tormented young woman. Then Kieran found an actress to bring Leanne's diary entries to life. Here's a selection from the diary of Leanne Wolfe.
I didn't write in ages. Been a bit occupied. Had a horse riding show today. Had to do a 6-course jump. Wasn't too bad, except for the fact that I knocked over pole number 2. Personally, I think it was the horse's fault. Anybody who was riding grumpy knocked over a pole. Dear Diary, I'm getting my hair done tonight. Not sure yet what I'm getting done. I think I am getting all over brown, with a small bit of redness going through it, and blonde underneath. But I don't know yet. Got to go. Leanne. 19th of February, 2004. I met this fella, and now I'm meeting him, all excited. He gave me a hickey last night. It's horrible. Well, I have to go to clean the house. I was down by the black hole and my mum rang me and asked me where I was. I told her. What a fool. About 2 minutes later, my dad was up by the hump telling me to get out now. In front of everyone. My room is locked with a key and the music is blaring. I'm trying to wreck their heads. I'm now mortified thanks to my dad.
Hate them so much. My room is locked with a key and the music is blaring. I'm trying to wreck their heads. That's normal. That's normal, like. So I remember Trina Netney being caught in a field, do you know what I mean? And no, she was doing nothing. There was no drinking, no nothing, but it leads to death. Do you know what I mean? When they hang, and I think big gangs anyway leads to trouble. Where is it now?
That was August, the other three as well.
The counsellor said to him, when she read them, like she said the first time she read them, she was hysterical. She said she was, I was shocked, like, because I was thinking we're not after eating them. And here's somebody telling us that's dealing with suicide and probably, she said, no, she said she never came across diaries like Leanne's, but she said Leanne knew every emotion. For someone so young, she said she would wake in the morning and she'd know what emotions she'd have, like, she'd be able to tell you, like, she's able to write it down.
Dear Diary, almost 2 weeks ago, I went to Dungarvan for the day. That was grand, but I wanted to stay for more. But after a couple of days, Mary One and another friend started to leave me out of things. I really felt there was something wrong with me or something. What do you think?
I really felt like there was something wrong with me or something. What do you think?
That's the start of it, really.
The start of it, Jen.
The isolation, kind of. She's been left on her own, like. That's after, and it's only minor now, but it kind of, even at that stage, Leanne felt it, like.
She's 14 now.
But when you look at it now, you know where it's going to lead to.
Dear Diary, today is Paddy's Day. I went to the Savoy. Myself and Mary One had a huge fight, and now her, Mary Two and Mary Four are after me. I thought we were getting close. Don't think we'll be like that anymore. I'm freaked out of my head. She's always fighting. I don't know what to do. They only use me. I don't need them telling me I'm fat. I don't know why the boys are getting involved. I even stay in at home over them and make myself sick. I will prove them wrong. Got to go. Love, Leanne. Dear Diary, Mary One started on me. First it was a normal fight. Then she came in fighting with me. I hate her so much. He keeps calling me fat. And then John Two called me and said, I can't call anyone fat. He was basically calling me fat. What's he getting involved for? I was on the phone to John Three, and Mary One threw a sneaky dig. Mary Three has a lot to do with it. She's the only one Mary One listens to, and she wouldn't stop her.
She was hysterical, because she wasn't used to fighting, and she wasn't used to violence. So when we got her down home, her eye was swollen, but it was all down the side of her left side of her face. And her eye was black, it was closed, and eventually when we calmed her down, we were standing, I can still see it, we were standing in the middle of the kitchen by the island. Mm-hmm. And the three of us, there was me, her dad and Trina, and we were trying to get out exactly what happened, and she told us. And it came out that it wasn't the first time, even though it's not in the diaries, but it came out that it wasn't the first time that she was after hitting Leanne. And I was saying, what do you mean? She said pushing her and, you know, bumping up against her, and all this came out on that night. And we went to the mother of the child that was bullying Leanne. And we thought we did get it sorted, but we made it clear, her father made it clear, Leanne's father made it clear, that if it wasn't sorted, and that if she even came near Leanne with a barge pole, that he was going to the guards. So we thought, like, that when we left, that we had it sorted and that would be the end of it. But it wasn't.
Dear Diary, good morning.
Good morning. It's now 8:15 a.m. and
it's 8:15 in the morning. I just finished packing to go to Portugal. Decided not to take the diary, but now I am.
But now I am. I'd probably be so bored over there.
When I come back, I don't know where I am. Mary One is getting Mary Two after me. Mary One, I swear, is some asshole. I hate her. She keeps telling people stories about me. That I'm a tramp. That I'm a fat tramp.
And that I'm a tramp, I'm a fat tramp. And then she kind of, you know, it's kind of comes in like, she knows this girl knows after when she comes off that plane, like. And then this is where it kind of the beatings come in, do you know, because it's not name calling no anymore. It goes to beating, but then it goes back to the name calling, like. Dear Diary Monday, I'm finally in Portugal. And I swear I can't.
I can't handle the heat. Got a bit burnt. When I go back, Mary too is looking for me. I don't want to be fighting with her. This is all thanks to Mary One. I hate her so much. It's so hot out here.
She didn't really enjoy the holiday, I'd say, thinking about coming home because she was excited about going. And her diary's like, she doesn't care about the holiday. You know, she just...
Dear Diary, Mary too came up to me Monday screaming and shouting. I was so scared, so sick of life. I never felt so depressed. I wish I had a new life. Say World War II is about to happen. I am sick of it. I am so sick of her fighting with me.
I was getting, do you know what I mean? The way it comes in, but you see how serious it is when she says, you know, when I see that part, like, I know, see, she was very deep, like, shouted at me, I wish I had a new life, do you know?
The Diary of Leanne Wolfe, produced by Kieran Cassidy with Peter Woods for RTE Radio in Ireland, winner of the Third Coast Festival Radio Impact Award. As you might imagine, the story inspired a huge response. It made both newspaper and television headlines and put bullying on the map as a social problem in Ireland. Now, producer Kieran Cassidy is working with education officials to present the story in schools in hopes that similar tragedies can be avoided.
S for sound.
Well, you see, the first actual communication was when one person spoke to another person and they understood what they were saying. And then it goes on for thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years.
Sound.
Most listeners don't need to be reminded of how riveting radio can be. But maybe you occasionally need to be reminded that great radio doesn't grow on trees. The stories that come to you over the airwaves have been meticulously conceived of and crafted by talented radio storytellers, which is why every year the Third Coast Festival takes a moment to recognize one producer, one luminary, who has not only had a great impact on listeners, but has made his or her mark on radio itself. This year, the Third Coast Festival Audio Luminary Award was given to Newfoundland-based Canadian producer, teacher, mentor, and avid sound recordist, Chris Brooks.
Okay, this is a recording of the Fort Amherst foghorn.
I make a lot of recordings, like this one. This is the sound of fog rolling into the harbor past my house. When I'm recording, it's the sound of the present. I put the tape on a shelf, and when I play it back, days or weeks or years later, of course, it's become the sound of the past. A little spool of memory, measuring the gap between then and now. And I feel like there's something sad about the gap, but I don't know why. It's just things changing. Of course, this isn't really the sound of fog. Fog is something you can't hear on the radio. This is a foghorn, a thing that evolved entirely because of fog. So it's kind of like the voice of fog.
That was part of Map of the Sea, a story about the end of the fishing industry in Newfoundland by Chris Brooks. Chris has been called a radio artist, documentary novelist, choreographer of sound, poet, composer, and wizard. He's been producing radio for almost 40 years for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and his own production company, Battery Radio. Appropriately enough, Battery Radio is located at the foot of the hill in Newfoundland, where inventor Guglielmo Marconi was stationed when he sent his first transatlantic wireless transmission of sound.
Sono lieto di poter rievocare in poche parole le esperienze delle prime trasmissioni radiotelegrafiche.
Here's Chris, accepting the 2008 Audio Luminary Award at our annual ceremony in Chicago.
Our job, I think, as radio makers, is to portray reality and to make that reality come alive between the listener's ears. And I think that is not unlike the sorcerer's art, who chalks a pentangle on the ground, and where he does that, we frame a story on the radio. Where he adds chicken feathers and toad's blood, we sprinkle the colors of sound and of silence, importantly of silence, and of the relationship between those two. Where he chants incantations, we offer the script of narrative and the voices of the characters we introduce. If the sorcerer be gifted, if the signs auspicious, and if the wind blow from the east, a spirit will be summoned and made manifest within that magic circle. And if we be so lucky, the spirit we summon will manifest itself between the listener's ears. Our spirit is truth, and making it manifest is our job.
Chris Brooks, accepting the Audio Luminary Award from the Third Coast Festival. As Chris said, radio producers, if we're doing our job, are part journalist, part sorcerer. We have to be. Our job is to transport you to another time and place. Now, science fiction has forever obsessed about some kind of contraption that could send you to the past or to worlds unknown, a machine that could take you to strange and wonderful places. But we radio producers know the big secret. The magic has been here all along, on the radio.
What is that extraordinary juice that happens sometimes about particular tones or timbres of sound? And how they strike the ear.
Which is the more powerful key to the senses, generally? And I think it's the ear.
Thanks for joining us for this hour of the 2008 Third Coast Festival broadcast, featuring the winners of the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation competition. I'm Gwen Maxey. The program was produced by Delaney Hall and Katie Mingle for Chicago Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. To learn more about the Third Coast Festival, to hear all of this year's winners or winners from years past, to subscribe to our podcast, or find out about our annual public audio challenge, go to thirdcoastfestival.org. The executive director of the festival is Johanna Zorn. The artistic director is Julie Shapiro. Many thanks to Third Coast Festival intern Ben Winter. The Third Coast Festival is made possible with lead funding from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation and additional support from American Airlines and Chicago's Navy Pier. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Music Shop and Pro Sound Center, now in their new location at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign. The Music Shop offers private lessons on all instruments in their brand new studios. They also provide a complete band and orchestra instrument repair and service department.
Some rain, drizzle, and snow, but little or no accumulation will be in the forecast for this Christmas Eve, according to meteorologist Scott Olthoff. After a high of 38 today, temperatures falling through the afternoon, down to 15 tonight. And then tomorrow, Christmas Day, clouds in the afternoon, a high of 32. Some light freezing rain possible late tomorrow night, low 28. And on Friday, rain likely at a high of 50. This is WYLL, AM 580 and FM 90.9, HD2 and HD3, Urbana.